This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is Jason Hartman with episode number 672. Thank you for joining me today, listeners from around the world, from 164 countries, and greetings from Daytona Beach, Florida. Yes, this is the beginning of my week-long property tour through Florida, looking at different markets, looking at properties, headed down to Tampa this afternoon to look at properties there. We've got several appointments with different potential local market specialists there, and I think it'll be an interesting visit, and I am going to be heading through some of the areas that were really ground zero for the real estate bus. These are all the areas that you heard about as the economy was crashing and the disaster was raging. And one of the big problems that happened here in these Florida markets, other than the obvious foreclosure crisis, subprime lending bubble, etc., is a lot of people that were calling themselves real estate investors were hiring builders to build their homes. And then the market was booming to such a degree that builders would literally walk off the job and leave their house that they were building, or a duplex or fourplex, whatever it was. Maybe it happened in big institutional apartment complexes too, I don't know. But they'd leave it unfinished. That, of course, is a total disaster. And that's why we like to focus the vast majority of our inventory on turnkey rental properties. We rarely stray from that, but we do a little bit here and there if the deal's good enough. And that can present a whole other set of challenges, but sometimes some opportunities too. So, you know, like the old saying, folks, and this goes for everything I'll ever say to you, okay? I'm making a little disclaimer for myself here. And that is the old saying that no rules or laws apply absolutely, including this one. That's like the English language. That's the problem with the English language, you know. It's got these rules, and then it's got all these exceptions to the rules, and that makes things really difficult because they don't follow real good logic some of the times. Remember, I before E, except after C, but not always, right? Or is that always? I can't remember now, even. but anyway, you remember back to grade school, and you know what I'm talking about. It seems like so many of these millennial generation, a lot of those are our tenants, as we've talked about many times. They graduate college and they can't even spell. They don't know the difference between Y-O-U-R and Y-O-U apostrophe R-E and a million other words. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me. It's just crazy. Wouldn't that be embarrassing if I just misspelled that myself? As I'm sitting here in the car, I'm actually coming to you from the automobile studio, not the Tesla, just a crappy rental car, and getting started on my journey here in a moment. Okay, so what else do I want to talk to you about? Gosh, here is one of the things, before we get to our guest, one of the things that really strikes me about investing as I'm looking at these properties. And this is not really news probably to you, because you are the informed listeners, the informed investors, of course, because you're listening to, well, you're none other than yours truly. Thank you for listening. It's people that just, I mean, even local market specialist contenders to be our local market specialist, people who own significant amounts of property or have dealt with significant amounts of property, they really don't even understand some of the most basic fundamentals of investing, of leverage, of inflation and deflation, of simple rent-to-value ratios. Blows my mind all the time. This amazes me many times a week, I'll put it that way, probably actually a couple of times a day when I'm talking to different investors. And some of them, the world would revere and think that they are doing it just right and they are great investors. Unfortunately, many times they're not. Well, if you want to learn to be a great investor, there's a couple things you need to do. Number one is you need to standardize your data. If you go to jasonhartman.com and you look at the property section on our website, which you definitely should do now because that inventory is being eaten up very, very quickly. Most of our clients understand this challenge that's going on in the marketplace right now with inventory. But it's being eaten up very quickly, of course. But you'll see that our data is standardized. You know, 12 years ago, when I became a nationwide investor, that is quite literally one of the very first things I did was standardize the data. You've got to look at standardized data. In other words, learn how to read by watching the video at jasonhartman.com right on the front page. And if you've watched it once, you probably need to see it again. It's only, 27 minutes? And if there is one thing that will sum up how to be a great investor in 27 minutes, it is that video on how to analyze a real estate investment, how to read a pro forma. And that's available right at jasonhartman.com, right on the front page. Also, of course, on my YouTube channel as well. So that sums it up, and it will help you. Of course, there's more to it than that, but I tell you, if you didn't know anything else, that would really do the job for you. So look at the website, look at the properties, notice that the data is standardized. If you want to learn more about the numbers on those sheets, just watch the video on the front page of jasonhartman.com. And use your own software to do this. Go to the resources page on jasonhartman.com and click on property tracking and analysis software and just get that software for yourself. It's almost nothing, the cost of it. It's so cheap. And you get a little special when you do it through our website. And it will really, really help you. You can look in the App Store if you use an iPad or an iPhone. No Android, sorry, for that software as well. Just go to Property Evaluator in the Apple App Store. And you can find it there as well. But I still like the good old-fashioned web-based version, the SaaS, S-A-A-S, Software as a Service product, which is at jasonhartman.com on the resources page. I just love that. So check it out. Take advantage of it. Really got to use that. You got to use it to not only analyze your real estate investments, but to track them as well. And you need to join us. Just one more thing before we get to our guest here. You know, there's always one more thing with me, right? You probably learned that by now. Join us for our Ohio property tour. The greater Cincinnati metro area, you're going to love this tour. We're going to do the Creating Wealth Seminar, which is our fundamental core seminar. I've got literally maybe a box and a half of those banker's boxes with testimonials and evaluations that are, for the vast majority, glowing evaluations. The only time I really get a real bad evaluation at my seminar, I hardly have any. Thank you very much. I must be doing something right. I'm going to reach around and pat yourself on the back. No, I'm really not this cocky. I just do it tongue in cheek. But the only time I ever get someone complaining at my seminars is when I start talking about politics. Well, our guest speaker coming up today is going to talk a little bit about politics, but mostly about fiscal and monetary stuff and investing. And I think you'll enjoy what she has to say. Yes, in 1 week, in two consecutive episodes, we have two women on the show. I would so much love to have more females on the show. They just kind of self-select, not as many of them in the world of finance and economics and wonky investing stuff as we need. We try to get him on the show, and we've got one today, and I think you'll really enjoy her interview. Nicole is a chartered financial analyst, contributor to the New York Times, contributor to the New York Post, contributing editor at the Manhattan Institute City Journal, and the author of After the Fall, Saving Capitalism from Wall Street and Washington. I love that title because there's nothing capitalistic about Wall Street. Do not be deceived. Do not fall for the rhetoric or the hype. Wall Street is a rigged game. It's a closed system. It is anti-competitive. It is cronyism. It is not capitalism. That does not represent capitalism at all. So don't think that Wall Street is capitalistic. And certainly Washington isn't either. But you know what struck me as funny about her interview is why is it that everybody has to do the politically correct thing, right? And they have to mention Donald Trump and then say that they're not a Trump supporter. I couldn't believe it. You know, I don't have television at home. I just have internet access. That's it. But last night I was watching CNN in my hotel room here in Daytona Beach. Of course, the Communist News Network, otherwise known as CNN, was on. And they kept playing this tape over and over of all the stupid things Donald Trump has said. And I agree. He says some really stupid things. The guy is weird. Okay? I'll be the first to agree with you. But, I mean, they just kept playing the same tape over and over. Like, coming in from every commercial break. And then you add to that that Facebook, shame on Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg, shame on you. I mean, listen, I love your product. I think you've done an incredible job at it. But shame on you. Do you know why I'm saying that, folks? I'm saying that because Facebook has been outed. No, not for selling your privacy to the lowest bidder or the highest, whichever way you want to look at it, not for lying about their privacy policies and misleading people, not for any of that stuff. No, they have been outed for literally suppressing free speech. Yes, you may have heard this. It was in USA Today. It's been all over the media. But I'm sure you won't see it on Facebook too much. And that is, a Facebook employee has admitted that they routinely suppressed conservative and or Republican news in the news feeds and played up liberal and Democratic news. So everybody just needs to understand, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, that you are generally bathed in a global, vast conspiracy toward the power grabbers. And guess what the power grabbers like? They like bigger government. They like socialism. They really love communism because communism's great for all the people at the top. So this is what the ultra-rich and ultra-powerful and the political elite, this is what they do. It is a concerted global effort that has been going on for decades and decades. You don't believe me? Look at the universities. I mean, look at the schools, the Common Core education that they otherwise known as the Communist Core, okay? And all of the, it's just omnipresent. It's like air. It's the remember a few episodes ago I talked about context versus content? Well, this is the context of almost everybody's life nowadays. It is the backdrop under which we all operate and live. It is so powerful. It is so incredibly strong. And I'm sure all of my liberal friends will say the complete opposite. And listen, I'm liberal on many things, okay? So don't try and paint me as some, you know, right-wing conservative person, because I'm just into small government and big freedom. That's what I like. I think that the libertarian ideal is about the closest to my ideology. And remember, libertarian, one of the key components of it is liberal, okay? It's just liberal with small government. So, you know, how can you complain about that? Regardless of what you think, what side of the aisle you're on. Just go read Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand and change your life and your thinking. It's phenomenal. I know a lot of my listeners have read that, of course. And, you know, I disagree with Ayn Rand about a bunch of things too, but overall, she's pretty interesting lady for sure. The late Ayn Rand, A-Y-N Rand. That's one of the things I noticed about our guest today. But the other thing I noticed about our guest today is that the vast Wall Street conspiracy is so powerful, just like this political backdrop of big government, liberal ideologies, meaning socialism, control, regulate everything to death, blah, blah, blah. You know, those negative parts of liberal ideologies I'm talking about. Her investment recommendations, oh, you know, buy the index fund. It's never about the most historically proven asset class in all the world. And I guess you could say in all world history, right? And that is income-producing real estate. So it's just amazing. Why is it that we only consider investors people who invest in the vast Wall Street conspiracy? It's just totally silly. It makes no sense whatsoever. But again, that is the backdrop of this vast messaging, these marketing campaigns that are hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions. I mean, I really have no idea how big the marketing for Wall Street is in any given year, but it's insane. There are so many tentacles to this ugly monster. Just control your destiny. Buy some income-producing real estate. Pay attention to it. Manage it. Be a good manager of your managers, or self-manage, even better, in my opinion. But, you know, depends what's for you. We'll teach you how to do either. That's what you should do. All right. Well, without further ado, let's hear from our guest, Nicole. And I think you will enjoy this interview. Go and register for our Cincinnati property tour, jasonhartman.com, in the events section. And enjoy our Creating Wealth boot camp while you're there as well. And I look forward to seeing you real soon in Ohio for that. Okay, let's get to our guest. It's my pleasure to welcome Nicole Gelinas. She is a chartered financial analyst. She's a contributor to the New York Times and New York Post, contributing editor to the Manhattan Institute's City Journal, and author of After the Fall, Saving Capitalism from Wall Street and Washington. And as you know, you regular listeners, I certainly believe that capitalism needs to be saved from Wall Street and Washington, that are really cronyist organizations. So let's dive in with Nicole. Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
Good. It's good to have you on the show. And is it correct to assume that you're coming to us from New York?
Yes. Right by Grand Central.
Fantastic. Well, talk to us a little bit about the crony organization. I call it the modern version of organized crime. It's known as Wall Street and Goldman Sachs and this really crony cartel that exists that I used to believe was capitalistic, and I no longer do. How are we going to save capitalism from Washington and Wall Street?
Well, what's interesting is that the voters are really trying to save capitalism in their very imperfect way. If we look back to 2008, people all across the political spectrum were very upset at these bailouts that we saw starting in the spring of 2008 and continuing through the fall and really continuing until today. And people weren't upset because they don't like to see rich people, or they don't want people to make more money, or they don't like bankers. They're just upset because they can see that this is not a fair system. You know, if a bank does very well and it succeeds or fails on its own merits and people are paid well, that's terrific. But people could see that these large financial institutions, many of them should have failed. They should have gone bankrupt. Their creditors should have lost money, and that did not happen. The government stepped in to save them, whether it was AIG or Citigroup or Bank of America, through these extraordinary bailouts. And then the people who represent the industry, they very, very infrequently acknowledge the public's right to be upset. A lot of times what you heard from people like Jamie Dimon in charge of J.P. Morgan Chase, or Steven Schwarzman in charge of Blackstone, was people kind of complaining that it was so terrible that everybody hates banks and everybody hates capitalism. But that's not true. People just see that this is an unfairness, and the political class has never understood this either. If you look at the 2008 election, Obama seemed like the best candidate to come in as an outsider, and McCain said ridiculous things about the financial industry, which made it seem like he just didn't even know very much about it. It didn't give the voters a lot of confidence. And then in 2012, Mitt Romney, of course, was a representative of this industry, and that doesn't make you automatically disqualified in this political environment, but he never acknowledged that people had very serious concerns about this industry. And now, of course, we had a succession of establishment candidates try their best and fail to take on Trump, because Trump, for better or for worse, and maybe for worse, is seen as the outsider here. But whatever you think of the candidates, it is healthy that the public does not want to see this establishment and this failed establishment really come back to rule us.
I agree that that is very, very healthy, that the public is fed up with this. And when we see someone like Hillary Clinton, I mean, she's just part of the game. She's in with all of that. And America was not designed to be a country where we have these political legacies, whether they be Kennedys, Bushes, or Clintons. I just think that in and of itself is problematic, not even talking about Wall Street and Washington per se. But do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's just insane that people thought Bush had any kind of chance. And I'm not a Trump fan. I don't support anybody. But this idea that his brother had the biggest repudiation of the system of free market economics that anyone has ever seen in his or her lifetime, presided over the worst economic crisis that we've seen since the Great Depression, and of course many foreign policy issues as well. But the idea that his brother could somehow win this primary, it just shows how out of touch the party is and was. And again, I don't support Trump, but I can see why other people, out of tremendous frustration more than anger, have voted for him. And frankly, Hillary Clinton has had almost as difficult a time. Bernie Sanders is still doing well. It is the middle of May. The primary season is almost over. She hasn't put him away as Trump put his 16 opponents away. And Bernie Sanders will probably win in West Virginia. He'll probably win a few more primaries in a few more weeks. And people have not gotten the message that this election is over. They are still taking time out of their busy days to go and vote against Hillary Clinton, even though they are told there's really no point in doing it. And it shows how strongly people feel about this establishment.
They sure do. And, you know, I can only hope, Nicole, that this really leads to a real third party eventually. Certainly not in this election cycle, maybe in the next one, maybe in the one after, maybe it's 2024, who knows. But if we could see a real potential for a Libertarian Party, that would be wonderful news to me. Many out there listening might be, say, it's Green Party, whatever. I would just love to see some breakup of the two-party system, because it's just a ridiculous concept in general. When we look at Wall Street, though, I don't think you mentioned the name that just, you can't have this discussion without talking about Goldman Sachs. I mean, that group has been criticized in so many different ways, and I think deservedly so. You know, more than any other bank, they have had this giant impact on Washington, on Wall Street, on Main Street. Just what are your thoughts in general about Goldman, or anything you want the listeners to hear?
I think one of the problems, whether it's Goldman having top-level people go to work in the Treasury, or whether it's Citigroup having people like Robert Rubin advise Bill Clinton back in the Clinton administration and then go to work for Citigroup and be very closely related to Clinton ending Glass-Steagall, and then Citigroup obviously being able to become much, much larger while he was there. There is this problem with Washington policymakers. They tend to think that whatever is good for the financial industry must be good for the country. And I think that is slowly going away. We don't see that.
That isn't true at all. The financial industry is full of these kings and queens, these kingpins that intend to just rule over the lower classes, over the hoi polloi. It's interesting that you mentioned this because I just returned, and we're not talking about central banking per se, but I just returned yesterday from Jekyll Island, Georgia, where I hosted my mastermind group there, and that's the auspicious birthing place of the Federal Reserve. And it was just so interesting. We had one of our meetings in the actual room that is called the Federal Reserve Room, where the Federal Reserve was created just over 100 years ago. And what a massive conspiracy. I mean, just, you know, even if you're not a conspiracy theorist, you just have to realize how incredibly powerful this is. But they're part of the bankster group. These are all just banksters, right? I stayed in J.P. Morgan's condo when I was there. You know, it's fascinating. Fascinating how these people, they still rule the world after all this time.
Yeah, I think the problem is if you come from this industry, you tend to naturally look out for it. And it's true in any industry. I mean, if I came from the steel industry, I would think it was a terrible crisis, all of these below market price steel dumping that China is doing right now and harming the Western world steel industries. It's not really done on a free market basis. But in all of the millions and millions of manufacturing jobs lost over the past four decades, the upheaval that the working class, the middle class has seen, no one ever said, this is a terrible crisis, we have to do something about it. But when it came to the financial industry in 2008, people said, we can't have these firms fail. It would be a terrible crisis. And it's certainly true that you don't want your whole financial industry collapsing all at once. It never should have got to that place. But people can see, no one ever cared when they were losing their jobs, when they were losing their income, and then when Wall Street got into a crisis, suddenly all of the important people care. And that has really contributed a lot to our toxic politics.
Talk to us a little bit about, you know, I guess maybe I'm asking for a prediction here, Nicole. Is there another shoe that's about to drop? We look at incredibly complex legislation that came out of the financial crisis, like Dodd-Frank, for example. So hard to understand. What is it, 2,200 pages or something like that? Do we have safeguards this time around, or are we on the verge of another crisis? You know, these seem to come every 10 years. Granted, the last one was the biggest in 70 years.
And it is almost 10 years.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the housing market actually peaked more than 10 years ago. If you think about house prices peaking nationwide in the spring of
2005 or 6.
Right. Yeah, I mean, people always say, well, what if we have a lost decade? Well, we just did have a lost decade. It's not really a theoretical thing anymore. Will there be another crisis? Could there be another crisis? I think, of course. I mean, I wouldn't predict when, but we haven't stopped this boom and bust cycle. There are a lot of worrisome things that almost, you know, you don't really need a crisis to be concerned about what's going on today. I mean, house prices are still too high. Since 2008, we've had a policy of trying to prop up house prices. And because why do we do that?
Well, let me just interrupt you for one second. We've had that really since the end of the Great Depression because they've been subsidized by Fannie Mae.
Right.
Okay. So, but yes, we had it again with the CRA. We had it again with this very liberal
and
0% mortgage lending.
Interest rates.
But
I mean,
yeah, absolutely, no question. Yeah. And Wall Street too. I mean, look at Wall Street. It's the same phenomenon there, just in a different way. But go ahead with what you were saying.
Right. With less than 4% mortgages for many, many years, just up until the past few months, we've encouraged people to continue to go out and borrow too much money to buy their first home or buy a bigger home. And why do we do that? Well, if house prices really were to be where they should be, a lot of older people would lose their net worth. I mean, the baby boomers' net worth is so caught up in these housing prices. And so
it's tied up in their house, yeah.
Right. And so we continue to prop up this market so that we don't make our retirement crisis even worse than it would be. And yet we still have people, you remember the play Death of a Salesman, Willie Loman paid off his mortgage. I mean, we've got people in their 40s, 50s, early 60s, they'll never pay back their mortgages. They still owe a 30 years worth of mortgage on their house because they kept refinancing and taking money out and so forth. And we still don't encourage savings. It's impossible to save money. I mean, you used to get a form from the IRS saying how much income you made for the year, but now nobody gets those because nobody makes more than $100 worth of interest income. You know, you have to have a lot of money to make even a tiny little bit of interest because we're still encouraging borrowing rather than saving. Have we made
And we're also, I should just point out, and I know you know this, but we're also encouraging risk-taking, malinvestment, speculative activities amongst groups of people, demographic cohorts, that are at the age where they should really be very conservative, but they can't because of monetary and fiscal policy. They are forced into these very risk-laden investment strategies because there's no yield in laddering CDs anymore, which you could do that in the old days and have a reasonable yield and have a reasonable retirement, albeit, of course, it gets eaten up by inflation. And just one other thing I want to mention, too, you respond to it whenever you like, or maybe just leave it as a rhetorical comment, and that is that you are absolutely right that nobody's really paying their mortgage off anymore like Willie Loman did in Death of a Salesman. But I would argue on a philosophical basis, you're absolutely right. That's very disconcerting. But on an individual basis, I would argue that that's actually a great strategy. You know, why pay it off? It's so cheap to borrow the money. You should just keep it out. And even if you had the cash, use it for something else.
Yeah, it would be fine if they had money saved up somewhere else and they were just doing this as a financial strategy. But most
good
people,
point, but they really only have $3,000 in the bank,
right.
And it's not a financial strategy. It's a necessity.
I do wonder, what are people going to do when they retire? I guess a lot of people just won't retire, which is fine. I think working is good. Working probably keeps a lot of people alive, and you know, keeps your mind active, keeps you busy. But if you start to decline, you know, very late in life, and you're unable to work. For people to go down to just having Social Security income and maybe not have as many opportunities to borrow money, it will be a very difficult transition.
Yeah, very good point. Very good point. And especially if they need very expensive long-term care. No question about it. Okay, so back to that concept of the other shoe to drop and anything we've done to prevent it, whether it be Dodd-Frank or anything else, or maybe the better question is, what strategies should listeners be adopting to protect themselves?
Well, I think the good news is we have some higher capital requirements. We really didn't need Dodd-Frank to get these higher capital requirements. I don't know why you need a 900-page bill and then tens of thousands of pages of rules and regulations that go along with the law to do what the Fed could have already used its discretion to do.
I'll tell you why. Yeah, because there's a bunch of cronies that you need to offer pork barrel legislation to.
But I think for personal finance strategies, I always think it's very simple. I mean, save as much money as you can. First of all, make as much money as you can. I mean, most people's financial problems are because they don't make enough and they spend too much. I mean, there's almost no financial engineering strategy that can get you around. Make more money, spend less money, and save more money. And so the first thing you do is you should really have a year of expenses saved up that should not be in the stock market. And you say, well, wait a minute, I can't make any money in a savings account. That's not the point. You should have a year's worth of liquid assets. So if you lost your job, you can take some time to figure out what to do. And you say, well, that's impossible for me to do. Well, you have to start doing it. I mean, before you start messing around with the stock market or anything else, that's what people should do first. And I think after that, any money that you put into the stock market, over time, a wide portfolio of stocks, should still be a good idea for people who are don't need the money within the next 5 to 10 years. If this is money that you're planning on needing in the next 5 to 10 years, whether it's for your kids' college or you want to have more kids and buy a house or what have you, again, that money should not be in any risk markets. I mean, you have to really do the opposite of what the government wants you to do. If you're putting money in the stock market and the stock market were to go down by half again, don't come complaining and whining that you need to take that money out, because any money that you need within half a decade or a decade, you should not be taking any risk with it. Now, money that you want for retirement, money that you just want someday in the future, nothing wrong with buying a very low-cost index stock funds and just keep up with the global markets, or go get yourself a brokerage account and start building up, you know, 10, 20, 30 individual stocks so you get the dividends, you get the capital appreciation, and you know, really nobody should be doing short-term trading. You know, I have no idea what's going to happen to Exxon or Citigroup or any other company within the next few years. I do know if you put long-term money into these markets, you'll do all right. But the key is buy the stock and then just forget about it. You know, you buy Caterpillar, don't read the paper about the sales going down in the short term. You know, you shouldn't be thinking about it for 20 years.
And you're certainly not going to beat the high-frequency traders anyway. So
right. And yeah. Of course, you know, companies go bankrupt. I mean, you could say, well, what about Enron, other companies? Well, that's why you should never have very much of your money in one individual company. You're always going to make one very bad bet. And so you just, the key is, if you're going to be really hurt by that bad bet, you shouldn't be in that bet in the first place.
Right. And I'd like to just ask you, Nicole, as we wrap up, you mentioned house prices recently, and I know you have a chapter in your book entitled Safe as Houses, which is an old cliche. And I would very much agree with you that real estate is highly overpriced where you live in New York. I mean, it's massively overpriced. Granted, it may even go up more, but it's still fundamentally unsound. And in all of the higher price cyclical markets, whether it be anywhere in the Socialist Republic of California or South Florida or the expensive Northeastern markets, Washington, Boston, whatever, certainly New York, as I mentioned. But in these very linear, boring markets in the Southeast and the Midwest, where you can buy a $100,000 single-family detached home that you can rent to somebody for $1,000 a month, those just haven't seen this radical appreciation, at least not yet. They probably never will, because they're very linear in nature. But they produce fantastic returns without appreciation. You know, where you can get 10, 12% cash on cash, and if it appreciates, your overall return on investment can be 20, 30, even 40% annually with a modest average appreciation over the last couple of decades. What do you think of that? I mean, it seems like whenever I talk to a New York person, they're so sort of marinated in the financial markets there, even with you disagreeing with a lot of their tactics. You know, it just seems to be so omnipresent, the thinking that if you're an investor, well, you're going to invest in stocks. That's what investors do. Any thoughts on that? Any comment?
As a personal investment strategy, you know, people have to do what they feel comfortable doing. But if you live in one of these communities where you see house good value for house, you do the math, you figure out, I can rent this out on a permanent basis and I'm going to make X amount of profits. And of course, you have to keep in mind, it may be $100,000, but you'll have to spend $25,000 for a new roof. Maybe tenants cause damage,
yeah,
if you haven't been,
yeah,
a landlord before.
Yeah, we've got
before.
All that.
Maybe,
yeah, I understand all those,
right,
of course. Yeah.
Maybe you'll have to hire somebody to maintain the property if you have more than one property. I mean, it's a
hopefully you have a big portfolio of them. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, obviously a lot of large New York investors have purchased single-family homes on a very mass scale,
oh, yeah,
and are now some of the biggest landlords of single-family homes to renters. You know, is this a business as an individual should get into. It certainly may be good for people who don't mind taking the risk, don't mind doing the work and so forth, but it is still a risk-based business, and so that's up to people on how much risk that they want to take.
That is the problem. Everything is risk-based nowadays, and unfortunately, just putting your money in the bank is so risky because it doesn't earn anything after inflation and taxes.
Right.
You're losing money. It's that's what we really talked about before, is that this is the behavior that you have to engage in nowadays. You can't get away from it. You can't do these safe things anymore. Certainly you can't do bonds. Those don't make any sense, especially if we start seeing inflation rear its head again. So it's we live in interesting times, as the Chinese saying goes, right?
Yep.
Yeah, we sure do.
Yeah, I mean, as a policy issue, if you look at a 30-year bond, and maybe the state of New York or whomever is issuing a bond and the interest rate is 4%, if you are buying that bond, you really have to be saying to yourself, do I never expect interest rates to be higher than 4% for the next 30 years? Because if they are, and if they stay higher, you're going to lose a lot of money. And maybe that person is right. Maybe we'll never see high interest rates again. But I think a lot of people, they buy these bonds thinking they're safe investments, and they don't realize, you know, a bond fund, if interest rates were to go up to 6, 7, 8, 9 double-digit percentage rates, these bonds are just like stocks. They're just going to lose a lot of their value.
They'd be worthless, yeah. Right.
Yeah, I mean, they're not worthless, but bonds can certainly lose, you know, 20-30% of their value, even more. And I think a lot of investors don't realize that. They just think naturally they're safer than stocks. And so, of course, if you know the risk and you want to take the risk, I think it's fine, but a lot of people, they don't even know about the risk. They think these bond funds are just very good, safe investments.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Give out your website and tell people where they can find out more about you and your book and the Manhattan Institute.
Sure. We are at city-journal.org is the Manhattan Institute's quarterly magazine. And then we put up web items pretty much every day, too. So, you know, you don't have to just come every quarter. And then my book is called After the Fall, Saving Capitalism from Wall Street and Washington. And I'm on Twitter. Just look for my name, Nicole Gelinas.
Nicole, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jason.
I've never really thought of Jason as subversive, but I just found out that's what Wall Street considers him to be.
Really? Now, how is that possible at all?
Simple. Wall Street believes that real estate investors are dangerous to their schemes because the dirty truth about income property is that it actually works in real life.
I know. I mean, how many people do you know, not including insiders, who created wealth with stocks, bonds, and mutual funds? Those options are for people who only want to pretend they're getting ahead.
Stocks and other non-direct traded assets are a losing game for most people. The typical scenario is you make a little, you lose a little, and spin your wheels for decades.
That's because the corporate crooks running the stock and bond investing game will always see to it that they win. This means, unless you're one of them, you will not win.
And unluckily for Wall Street, Jason has a unique ability to make the everyday person understand investing the way it should be. He shows them a world where anything less than a 26% annual return is disappointing.
Yep, and that's why Jason offers a one-book set on creating wealth that comes with 20 digital download audios. He shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I like how he teaches you how to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And this set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered for only $197.
To get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia Book 1, complete with over 20 hours of audio, go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.